Session number 20966, Reel 6.
Janos, Carpushy Reel 6.
Right. Yes, the barbed wire, which we climbed over, and my wife tore her coat on it. And then we had another 100 meters to go, and we came to a football pitch with a large changing room, which was all laid out with mattresses, and we were given tea and cheese, and we were in Austria. And probably the best cup of tea and the most tasteful piece of cheese that we ever had at that time. It was about half full, that dressing room. So we settled down, the two of us, on two mattresses. And that was about just before midnight, and the light was still on, and people were drifting in and out, and there were people coming in terrible state, crying and torn clothes and shivering, and there were groups of three or single persons, and we began to hear the horror stories. There were many, but one of them was a man, absolutely shivering. He came through a different route. There is a lake across the border, Fertőtó, which is a sort of marshy area, and the lake itself is small, but the marsh around it is quite large, and they regard the marsh also as the lake. And he came with a group of people, and then they met with border guards, and they waded into the water, into the marshy water, and they stood up to the hip in the water for 2 days, he said. And he is the only one who came, because they were shooting at them, but they were amongst the reed and plants, and he was somehow protected from view. And he was the only one who survived. And then we met their people who lost their partners in the border, and that it was only then we realized how lucky we were, in spite of the difficulty with the screaming child and the half-blind grandmother and the pregnant mother, that we met nobody on the way, no border guards, and we really got across the border unobstructed. We were very lucky. From that, the name of the place was Klingenbach, and in the morning, then we saw really that just outside the corner of the football pitch, there was the watchtower. So it was virtually on the border between Hungary and Austria. We got there, I think, the 25th of November. The family with whom we went had some connection in Vienna, whom they telephoned, who came the next day and took us all in to Vienna. They took the family with them, but they deposited us in a room somewhere, which they rented for us, and we never met them, and we don't know where who they are. And we were told to go to partly the ministry office dealing with refugees, and also to various charitable institutions where they were distributing some food and money, because we had no money, nothing with us. And during the course of the day and the next day, we went to the British embassy or the consul to find out how we could get and when we could get to the UK, where we were told that there was such an enormous waiting list that it would be about 6 weeks or thereabout before we could be flown to the United Kingdom. And the prospect of staying in Vienna was daunting, because there were at the time about 220,000 Hungarian refugees in Vienna, and Vienna was bursting at the seams. They couldn't cope with such an influx, sudden influx of new people. When we thought that we might do something different, my wife had relations in Paris. Her aunt, her father's sister, who married a Polish deserter in 1918, and they left the country because he was running, and they went to France, and in 1956 they were living in Paris, to say if we could go to them and then hop over to the British Isles from Paris. It seemed much easier, and we were encouraged at the British consulate, saying yes, because there are tens of thousands who want to go to the UK from Vienna, but there won't be many who will want to go to the UK from Paris. So we went to the French consulate, and we said, could we come to Paris, because we have some relations there. They took the details, they checked whether these details were correct, they got in touch with the relations in Paris, they told us to come back a couple of days' time, and then we were told that that evening we got on a train in Vienna, and the train will take us to Paris. And in a coal train, we traveled 2 days or 3 days, I don't remember, but right across Europe from Vienna to Paris. We arrived in Paris on the 1st of December, 1956, where most of the train load were taken to hostels or camps or wherever, but we were taken out by our relations. And I have never seen them. My wife had only met the daughter once, who came to visit Hungary after the war, 1946 or 47. And after a couple of days, we went to the British consulate and said, here we are. We were told in Vienna that it should be easy to get to the United Kingdom from Paris. Can you take us somehow? And they said, no, we can't. Then they explained that by jumping Vienna, we have lost our refugee status. We are no longer refugees. And the only way we could get to the United Kingdom, if we had a labor permit, and on that basis they could give us a visa. They couldn't give us a visitor's visa because we didn't have passports. Well, we had no passports at all. We have never had Hungarian passports, neither my wife nor I. So we suddenly were in a desperate situation. They didn't want to stay in France. They didn't speak the language. Mind you, I didn't speak English. I read technical books fluently, but I didn't speak the language. And my wife matriculated in English, so she had some knowledge of English. And we started thinking what to do. And a bright idea came to us: buy a wireless world, which no longer exists now, but it was a very important magazine or professional periodical at the time. We knew that that was full of thousands of advertisements, job advertisements. So we bought a wireless world, and we started writing applications to jobs, to advertisements. And I know we wrote about 120 applications, certainly over 100 and over 110. And we waited for the replies. And that was about December the 5th or the 6th. And the replies came. How nice, and we were thanked for applying and thinking of the particular firm, and our qualifications and my experience was just right. But unfortunately, they couldn't offer a job without an interview, and they would be happy to interview when we come to England. Here I have to mention that my wife did the same course at university as I did, so she was an electronic engineer, and she graduated in 1956, in the late spring of 1956. So we were both after jobs. So there we were, not being able to get a visa without a labor permit, but not being able to get an offer or a labor permit without a visa to enable us to come for the interview. So it was an impasse, complete impasse. And that's how it went for a couple of weeks. Eventually, we thought that we just have to be realistic, and we looked for a job in Paris, and we both had a job with Thomson Houston in Paris, to take this job. We both had to go, undergo medical examination, which was quite thorough, where it was discovered that I was suffering from diabetes, which I never knew before. So I was immediately put on a very strict diet. But we started working, me without French and my wife with a little bit of French, because her second language at grammar school was French. And we started working, but we were not very happy. And then, just before Christmas, we had a phone call at my wife's uncle's house, that a Mr. Hall would like to talk to us when we came home from work. So we rang back at a given number, and of course my wife talked because I couldn't speak English, and Mr. Hall said that he was asked by his bosses in the United Kingdom, in Cambridge, to interview us as a result of our application, because they would be very interested to employ us. Could we join him for, I think, Christmas Eve or Christmas meal? And we were astonished. We had almost forgotten about the United Kingdom opening us ever. And we went and had a meal in restaurant which is called La Thermometer, the thermometer, I can't say it in French, which was on the Place de la Republic in Paris, where we met Mr. Hall, who turned out to be the resident engineer of Pi Limited, with the headquarters at Cambridge, in charge of a factory in Paris manufacturing television sets. So Mr. Hall interviewed us, and at the end of the interview he said, and interviewed me in English, which was quite a job on his part, and in the end he said that he thinks that we would make a great contribution, and he will recommend his bosses to offer us a job. And just before New Year, the job offer came, which was like development engineers, £750 per year for me and £500 per year for my wife, which without hesitation we accepted. We wrote back immediately, and they said that if in the offer letter that they will obtain a labor permit for us if we accept their offers. And so we waited, and around the between the 15th and 20th of January, the letter came with the labor permits, and it was all like a dream. We went to the British consulate, and the same man who said, "No, no, you can't do it. Get a labor permit." And I said, very with great pleasure, that here it is, sir, we have got labor permits. "Well done," he said, and issued us with visas on the basis of the labor permit. And on the 24th of January 1957, we sailed across the Channel to the United Kingdom. We landed in London and was absolutely bewildered, dark in the evening. It was an interesting crossing because we had by then a very small suitcase full of books and a change of underwear, nothing much more. And we saw all these people with dozens of luggages, huge suitcases, worrying what is going to happen to their suitcase, directing the sailors to put it there and pile them up here, and extremely worried about their possessions, and we had nothing to worry about, and it was such a light and interesting journey. We arrived in London. We had the addresses of some childhood friends who lived in London. We spent the evening night with them, and the next day we went to Cambridge, where we reported at the factory. And we came with a loan from a person whom we met about 2 weeks before, of about 60, 56 pounds or something like that, because we didn't have money at the time. That was the only reason why we could buy the tickets from Paris to Cambridge. And Pi were very good. They helped us to find a flat, which was again very interesting because they arranged with a don. I think he was a history don or a literature don, Mr. Lacey, in Cambridge, who gave us a room and shelter. And soon it turned out that there was a misunderstanding between Pi and the Laceys, because Mrs. Lacey thought that Agnes, my wife, will act as an au pair for their two baby children. But Agnes was working like I did, and so they had a word with Pi, and we said, very sorry, and she said, no, it's not your fault, but please stay with us. But we helped in the evenings and over the weekends, and we only stayed perhaps not even 2 weeks with them, because we didn't think it was fair to take advantage of their generous offer. And we found a room somewhere, Chesterton Road, I think, number 202, I think, I'm not sure, but I think it was that, with a charming old couple, very close to Pie Factory. And that's how our life in England, in the United Kingdom, began.
How has it suited you living in England and working in England?
Working was all right, because the work was technical. My wife had a more interesting opportunity than me. It was very much in the area where she wanted to work. My work at Pies was not where I thought I would be working. But the conditions suited, and the company was well known and advanced technologically, so that was fine. Life was a bit strange, because customs were different, and how shall I say, the food was different, and that probably was the biggest problem. Not problem, but the the area where we had to adapt to the new conditions. Also, we found that the climate was inhospitable, in the sense it was very damp compared to the dry cold in Hungary, and we felt cold most of the time. And also the heating of houses, we were astonished to find, was inferior to what we were used to Hungary, even under the communist regime. My father had the house built in 1927, and it had central heating with radiators everywhere. And it was hard to find central heating in any homes in the UK in the 50s, 60s even. There was an interesting experience that we were corresponding with our homes fervently, and we were writing diaries to each other. For us, it was the contact with the people at home was extremely important. But suddenly the letters stopped, and we couldn't imagine why. And I don't know why I came to the idea that they must be delivering the letters to the wrong address. And I started thinking where that could be, and I worked out that it must be 102 instead of 202. I went to 102, and I rang the bell, and by that time I knew about 24 English words. But there was no response, and I looked through the letterbox, and I saw a huge pile of letters on the floor. And I was convinced that those are our letters. And I thought, what shall we do? Can't get entry to the house. So we went to the police. I went to the police and I explained, I don't know how, but I did explain what happened. And the police came and checked my facts. And they saw the letters on the through the letterbox. A huge pile, tens of letters, dozens of letters. And they did some investigation. And they came back and said, there's an old gentleman living in the house, but he is in hospital. And the house is not lived in at the moment, but they have traced, I think, the son who has a key to the house, and would I come with them? So we opened the door, and there were our letters from Hungary, from Budapest, from our parents. And that was a bright day when those letters came to our hands. We were not entirely happy with Pies. We told them that the work is not, in my case, was completely unsatisfactory. It became clear. In the case of my wife, it was quite acceptable. But they would do nothing about it. So we looked around and we found other positions in Nottingham with Ericsson telephones, where we were both offered very interesting jobs. So in August 1957, we moved to Nottingham. By that time, we were discussing with Agnes's parents that they might join us if they can manage to get out of the country of Hungary. We settled very quickly at Ericsson's. We found extremely nice environment, very nice colleagues, an excellent boss, who, after we have left Ericsson's, asked us to become godparents to his adopted son, which we did with great pleasure, and we became great friends afterwards. But fortunately, he's dead, and she is dead also, recently died. But we're still very much in contact with the two adopted children, the son and later a daughter. We were encouraged to buy a house. And that was something fantastic. I mean, we came in January with a suitcase full of books. Oh, I have to say that there was a blanket, a grey blanket, which we still have, which was the blanket that my wife was issued in the concentration camp in Austria in 1944 when they were deported from Hungary. And we still have that grey blanket. We were encouraged to buy a house, so much so that the company stood as guarantor for 100% mortgage. And in 1957, November, we moved into our house, a new house, which we bought for £2,500. No deposit, because Ericsson's stood the guarantee, the surety. Agnes's parents joined us in October, late October. They obtained exit visas and passports from Hungary by giving their desirable flat in Hungary to a secret police official free, so that as a compensation he obtained the passports and the visas for Agnes's parents. They were allowed to bring out something like 40 kilograms each. So effectively and essentially,